Weeknights Live. Expert money and real estate advice every Sunday. Elise Glink is on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB. Brought to you by Mark Tytel with Realty First.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to the Elise Glink Show live on Sunday, 11 to 1. Our congratulations to Mark Tytel, who will be in the house a little bit later on, apparently. He had a baby girl this week. His daughter, Abigail, was born a couple of days ago, and he is on his way in. There's a whole bunch of news he wants to share with you this morning. So, again, congratulations to Mark. Our number, 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Online all the time, the new ThinkGlink.com, my new website, finally up and running. Very exciting. ThinkGlink.com. Sign up for the free weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter. Be a fan of the Facebook page. Go to Equifax personal finance blog at Equifax.com/blog. Go to Money Watch. We have a huge amount of information in the ThinkGlink community, all of it for free, all of it to help you make smarter decisions with your money. So I've been out on the road the last 3 weeks, and this week, in fact, tonight, I'm leaving to go to New York City, where then I will actually get into a car and drive another 45 minutes into Connecticut. And I've been giving speeches to all kinds of different people about everyday money. The topic is called everyday money, and in this speech, I talk about things that we can do every single day in our lives to save money. And the reason I talk about everyday money is because I believe that it's the little tiny things you do with your money every single day that are going to make the difference between having money and options in retirement or not. It isn't any more complicated than that. And as I've shown people, and there's been thousands of people who have listened to the speech, you know, there is money. It's not even the low-hanging fruit that you can find, because I believe that everybody can find money in their budget. This is stuff that fell off the tree and is rotting on the floor. It's so easy. And so I want to share with you a couple of things this morning that I've been telling people for ways that they can find money in their budget. And then I also want to share some of the questions that they're asking me, because it's very, very clear to me that people are in big trouble still in this country. And it's not just here in Atlanta. I was in Salt Lake City. I spoke to 250, 260 people over two speeches. And, excuse me, I'm a little hoarse from all my traveling. The first question I asked everybody is, raise your hand if someone close to you has been unemployed for at least a year. Almost everybody, I mean like 95% of the people who were sitting there listening to me, raised their hand and said they knew somebody who had been unemployed for at least a year. And as people came up to me afterwards at the end of the speech and shared stories, you know, it's like one woman said, my husband is an architect, and he got laid off 18 months ago. And it's not like he's about to get a job anytime soon. So he's been applying for jobs as draftsman, which is quite a bit step lower. And nobody will hire him to do that job because they're all like, look, you're an architect. And the minute the market improves, you're going to go and be an architect again. And then we're going to be stuck. So nobody wants to hire him. And, you know, it's a really tough, tough position. So I'm just amazed at how Americans have managed to muddle through this. We're now in our third year of the so-called recovery, and things stink all over the country. I was in Phoenix. I asked people to raise their hands if anybody was buying a house. Nobody raised their hands. Anybody buying investment property? Nobody raised their hands. Anybody want to refinance? Nobody raised their hands. Why? Because the Phoenix market is sort of the epicenter. Phoenix, Las Vegas, Michigan, Florida, I mean, it's the epicenter of the real estate catastrophe. Georgia, very hard to refinance right now because nobody has any equity. You basically have to have a paid-off house. So what are some things that people can do to help find more money in their budgets? Because I know that there are some people who have cut everything to the bone. That's what I call the Elise's zero-sum budget. Basically, you take everything off the table. Everything. Whatever you spend, you start with zero. And then you add back in everything you can't live without. Like if you don't pay your rent and you don't pay your mortgage, you're going to be on the street. Oh, that goes into the column. Is there anything left in the budget after you pay that? Oh, I need to, you know, pay the car bill so I can keep driving my car to work. Okay, that goes in the budget. That's the zero-sum budget strategy. It's my zero strategy. But people are really finding other ways to save money. So in every single place I've been, and I've been all over, I ask people to raise their hands and tell me if they have actually shopped around their cell phone plan recently. Now, Sam and I did that, and we managed to shave about $30 a month off of it because he noticed that the boys only text, right? And we have unlimited texting for $10. Great. But now in our plan, we have Sprint right now, and with the so-called friends and family, so many people are included that the number of minutes, we had a 2,000-minute per month plan, and we weren't going anywhere near that. And so he cut us back to 1,500 minutes a month. And we'll evaluate after a couple of months to just make sure that we're not going over that. But the truth is that instead of calling Sam, sometimes he and I are G-chatting, which doesn't count against our minutes because we're not using our phones. So there's it's really interesting to kind of think about that. But $30 a month. So I said, anybody else shopped around their cell phone plan? In every single city I've been to, somebody's raised their hand and said, I did. I saved $20 to $30 a month. If you haven't done this in a year, you may be able to squeeze a little bit more savings. $20 a month is $240 a year. So count on that, $240 to $360, and you're in a place where you're saving money. And these kinds of little teeny tiny everyday decisions are the things that are going to get you where you need to go. So I'll go through, you know, a little later on the show, we'll talk about a few more of those. And I want to hear what you guys are doing to save money. So 404-872-0750. If you've listened to the show for a little while, you know that we are all about sharing the wealth of information. So call in. Lines are open. Call in, and you can share your tips and strategies for saving money. And we'll see if we can get everybody saving. I'd like to save by the end of the show today. I'd like to give you a strategy to save $1,500 a year. Easy. I think we can get there. Right now, we're $240 to $360 a year simply by shopping around your cell phone plan, 404-872-0750. While we're waiting for the phones to light up, Scott joins us on the line from Brazelton. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Lisa. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good.
What's going on in your world today?
Well, actually, it's been going on for a while.
All right.
We've had a foreclosure, and we look at it, and looking backward, we're not victims. We messed up ourselves.
Okay.
But we reached a point where we decided that we needed to change things. I'm in my 50s. My wife is 50. And we wound up with a property through overruns on construction. It was on Lake Lanier. We wound up with a $700,000 mortgage.
Wow.
And, you know, when you going in three-fourths of the way into building, we knew we were going to go over. But it was my opinion that we should go ahead and complete and get in it. And this is in 07. Complete it, get in it, and then prepare to sell it in 2 years at a loss and possibly even kicking in money at the closing to just get out of it. Well, it's now back on the market. We defaulted on 695. It's on the market for 260.
Wow, and that's a big drop.
Oh, yeah. But where we're at now, my wife has a good job. I do, too. We're both still employed. We've been saving. And where we're at is we're seeing houses, we're renting, and we're seeing houses in our subdivision in the area that short sale, foreclosures, whatever. And we're seeing some that we like. And we think, you know, at price points, they're in the 200, 250 range. And we've saved, you know, a fair down payment, $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
So we've looked around. There's hardly anybody that will finance us, although we found one private lender that, you know, and being private, they want to make a profit. We're being quoted 12.5%,
yep,
which is high.
Yeah.
But the question is, now I'm a veteran, and I will get my VA back in 2 years. We've already checked into that. So the questions there are, is the market depressed such that if we go with the lender with the high interest rate, will we still be, which we looking at a monthly amount that we can manage, would we be better off to go into that now, or would we be better off to continue renting and wait for the 2 years and then look around?
I don't know why you would do this deal. What is it about the idea of owning another home that is so driving you that you would want to pay credit card rates to buy the house? What's driving the decision?
Well, the idea there being that we want to get to a point when I retire and she retires that we either own the home or we'd be at a price point to where we can manage the monthly payments for the rest of our lives.
So what are you paying to rent a house right now?
We're paying $1,900.
Okay, and when, let's say you buy one of these houses and you pay 12.5%, you pay taxes, you pay insurance, and you pay the upkeep and maintenance of the house, how much are you going to pay then?
We were looking at the our monthly outlay. We're figuring it's going to be between $2,500 and $3,000.
Let's just call it $3,000, because
okay.
I think it's always on the high side.
Okay.
And real estate taxes are only going up because all of the counties around Atlanta are broke, just
right.
Like they are in other places. So they're going to find ways to raise property taxes. So let's say it's $3,000 a month. You're paying $1,900 a month. That's $1,100 a month, or another $15,000-$16,000 a year that you're not putting into the house. So you're going to have $30,000 in 2 years when you can actually qualify to buy one of these houses. Now, let me give you another idea. Why don't you go find one of these houses that's for sale that they can't sell, and why don't you offer to do a lease with an option to buy in 2 years? So you do a 2-year lease, you get a portion of your rent credited back to your down payment, which you don't actually need, but why not? It would be free money, or if not, not. You settle on the price of the house now, and in 2 years when you can actually qualify for a 5 or 6% loan, right? Even
right.
A 7% loan over a 12.5% loan, you're making a smarter decision, and you've saved another $30,000. $30,000 goes a lot further towards retirement than having a paid-off house. Because the other thing you can do is then you'll put down $80,000 on a $200,000 house. You're taking a $100,000, $120,000 mortgage, for which your monthly payment will be probably somewhere around $1,300. So the difference between $1,300 and $3,000 a month, or $1,500 and $3,000 a month, is $18,000 a year. So in a very short period of time, you could pay off that entire house. Now you're in the same place, but you're so much further ahead.
Okay. But so a couple of my questions then are, you know, like I told you, it would be a couple of years I could get back my VA, and this is something we don't know the answer to. When we get there, when we say that, when I say I've got VA, I've never used it. So isn't using VA just another form of a guarantee to the lender? And then we, you know, in other words, if I go to my bank that we're banking with now, or, you know, 2 years from now when I get my VA back, I'll say, okay, I've got VA now. What's the possibility or probability that they will give me a loan at a decent rate at that point in time?
Well, I don't know where interest rates are going to be in 2 years. Nobody does. But
right.
They're sure as heck not going to be at 12.6%. Okay,
right.
So you're going to be doing better. I think you're going to be doing better by waiting. And I think what you have to do is understand really why you feel like you need to own a home today. I mean, I can promise you there are going to be thousands of great homes in great school districts in 2 more years that haven't sold, that have gone into foreclosure, because we're not near the end of this yet. We're not at a place where there are tons and tons of jobs and everybody wants to buy a house. So I don't see what the urgency is for you. I mean, when you do a foreclosure, it's 5 years, and that's a great time for you to build back your credit history. You're saving up money. You're doing all the right things. I just think waiting 2 more years is going to be the smart financial decision, as opposed to trying to do something now that I think buying a house for 12.6% is never going to be a great solution in my mind, because you may or may not be able to refinance in 2 years. And then you're going to be stuck with a 12% loan when everybody else is paying 5, 6, or 7%. And I just don't think it makes any sense. But, hey, Scott, let me know what you decide to do. 21 minutes past the hour. I'm Elise Gling. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more on News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on. Weekdays with Clark Howard and Dave Ramsey. And midday every Sunday with Elise Glink on AM 750. And now, 95.5 FM. News Talk WSB.
The hour. We are talking today about ways that you can save money every day in your budget. 404-872-0750. Charla joins us on the line. Quickly, Charla, how do you save money?
I learned of a little-known discount that our long-term care insurance company offers if you are a member of certain organization, that organization being the National Association of Federal Retirees, NARF. And so we contacted the insurance company, and we were given a $384 a year discount because of my membership.
Excellent. How much do you pay for the membership?
Mixed drinks, a techno
beer. Oh, because it's part of the net, because that's, you are a federal retiree, so you got that.
I pay like $40 a year for the magazine.
For the magazine. Awesome. That is a great return on investment. $40 and you get a $384 a year discount. I love it. What is your best way to save? 404-872-0750. We're trying to find $1,500 worth of savings for you today on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
37 minutes past the hour, 11:37 this morning. A little chilly outside, not bad on Peachtree Street. 404-872-0750 on the Elise Glink Show. Online with the new thinklink.com, thinkglink.com, 24/7, 365. Don't forget to sign up for our free weekly newsletter and check out all the cool stuff that we have. It's a lot easier to find stuff on the new improved thinklink.com, and I hope you'll check that out. Check out the Equifax personal finance blog, Money Watch, all kinds of cool information on the ThinkLink community. So today we're talking about saving money, very baseline, how you can actually pick up all the rotting fruit on the floor and use it to save yourself up to $1,500 a year in found money. This is stuff that's just, it's like a milk carton that leaks. You think about it being a big fat mess, and I think about it being pennies right down the drain. So we're trying to find ways in your budget, and the genesis of this, if you're just tuning in, is that I've been on this speaking tour all over the country doing a speech called Everyday Money, because I believe that the difference, the changes you make every day, the decisions you make every single day with your money are the decisions that are going to decide whether you are wealthy at the end of your life and not in trouble financially, or you are in big trouble financially. So our first way of saving was to go shop around your cell phone plan, and you ought to be able to save $20 to $30 a month, because there's a whole lot of competition out there. And that's $240 to $360 a year. Let me give you another thing that I know you can do. You can shop around your car insurance. Every place that I have been over the last 3 weeks, I have asked this question, and there's been at least one or two people who have raised their hand and said they've saved $300 a year by shopping around their car insurance. Now, add that to the $30 a month you're saving on your cell phone plan, and that's almost $650 a year, which is not quite halfway to our goal. But the other thing you can do is you can kind of stack insurances together and save 15 to 25%. For those of you who are listening who do have jobs and do work for big companies, companies often offer group insurance plans. We had somebody at a big company that I was speaking at this week raise his hand and say, I actually saved 25% across the board when I stacked three or four insurance policies with the group insurance plan of my company. So it's certainly worth checking out, because if you're spending $3,000 or $4,000 a year and you can save 25%, that's a grand. And that's really close, really close to $1,500. So very worthwhile to just shop it around and see. So I asked everybody to call in. You can also tweet your savings. I'm at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. You can call us at 404-872-0750. You can send me your money saving suggestions to thinklink.com. You just check out the thing that says Ask Elise. And then let's go to the phones and see what everybody's saving money on. Steve joins us on the line from Cumming. Hey, Steve, where are you saving money?
I'm saving money with my cable satellite provider.
Okay, so what did you do?
I just shopped around. A lot of companies are offering, like, promotional discounts and stuff like that for new customers, and I was paying about $100 a month, and I turned around and got it down to $25 a month.
Awesome. And are you getting almost the same channels? Are you taking a little bit less or different or what?
Yeah, I lost, like, 60 channels, but I still get, you still get 120 channels with that, and then after 12 months, it goes up to 35, so it maxes out at 35, so it starts out at $75 savings, and then it's eventually going to be 65.
You know what? I am loving that. 75, let's just call it 70 bucks a month, times 12 is almost, oh, that's just a ridiculous amount of money. That's like almost a grand a year right there.
Yep.
So good for you, Steve. That's a great way to save money. Thanks for sharing. 41 minutes past the hour. What is your favorite way to save? 404-872-0750. Lisa joins us on the line from Snellville. Lisa, how do you save money?
Well, what we did was when I took a pay cut to come home and stay with my kids, I took about a $10,000 a year pay cut. So to help us make that transition, what we did was we agreed that when we would eat out, we would not drink anything but water. So that saved us $4 or $5 a meal plus what you would tip on it, so you were between $5 and $10 every time you went out.
That's absolutely amazing.
Yes, it really made a huge difference, and we hardly even saw the difference in the $10,000 pay cut, you know, when you talked about washing your clothes or cleaning your clothes and all that type of stuff and savings on gas.
So you think you probably almost saved, how many times out a week were you eating?
We would probably eat out 3 to 4 times a week.
Wow, that's a lot anyway.
Things, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's like four, let's just call that 20 to 40 bucks a week, 20 bucks
exactly.
A week. Wow. That's just massive.
Yes, it was.
$1,000. Wow. Thank you for sharing. That's an awesome suggestion. I love it. I'm going to put it up on the website today when we do the blog post. Just terrific. 404-872-0750. What's your favorite way to save? I am on a mission. I am on a mission to get everybody to save $1,500 a year at a minimum. But look, we're already at over $2,000 in possible savings, which I think is amazing. Lisa, that was so great. Chuck joins us on the line from Marietta. Chuck, what's your favorite way to save?
Well, you know, when I first moved here, I understand the difference between variable and fixed. So when I signed up for my gas provider, I signed up for variable. And
okay.
I knew that over time that usually the variable rate will beat the fixed. And I just kept paying and paying and paying and paying. And this last year, you know, I mean, I'm looking at my house and I'm looking at how much heat I'm putting in. And I was looking at my therms and it said, you know, my variable rate now was 1.09. I said, that's just ridiculous. I just can't do that anymore. So I called, I talked to a real nice agent, and we went over, you know, the different rates and how you can get it down. And I said, well, I checked the Georgia website, you know, where they post all the rates. And I said, there's just got to be a way. I'm not in the house that much. I'm not heating a huge family. I said, can we get this down? So I got it down from 109, which is my variable rate, to 66.9. And that's like over 40%.
Wow. So how much are you saving?
Well, I would have to guess that, you know, depending upon, obviously, because I was on variable before, you know, I was heating my house. I think my highest heating cost is about $265. I just got my one. Obviously, we switched over from heat to cold.
Mm-hmm.
But my fuel bill for that month was $14.
Wow, really?
No, yeah. I mean,
oh my gosh, that's huge.
No, seriously, it was $14. Obviously, I had, like, you know, the service charge and the base rate.
Yeah.
AGSL, the base rate or whatever.
All the junky fees, I know.
Yeah. And so my, you know, to heat my house obviously is way cheaper. And so she put me on a fixed for 12 months. I think she kind of felt sorry for me because, you know.
You've already given them so much of that profit.
I was paying all this money. I said, this is ridiculous. I said, you know, I have two zones. I have a thermostat. You know, I have it set, you know, a couple degrees warmer than downstairs. You know, I'm doing all the right things, and it just was not adding up. So She put me on a fixed rate, you know, 66.9 for 12 months, and that will obviously save me, you know, when the winter's coming up, you know, for next year, because that just changed to, you know, around tax time when everybody,
yeah,
you know, looks at their budget, when they can save. And then I called my electric company and, just, you know, tried to do the same thing. Now, I'm probably not saving as much, you know, maybe another 10 or 15%, but they put me on a different plan, you know, and they're both EMCs, you know, so I think just, you know, everybody understands that, you know, you have your utilities and you really can't do anything about it, but I beg to differ. I think you can.
So what do you think you're saving? What do you think you will save, and what are you already saving over each month? Just at a conservative, you know, what do you think it'll be? Is it going to be you're going to save $150 a month here?
Oh, absolutely. Especially in the high month. I mean, my annual fuel bill for gas was probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $1,400. So I'm hoping it's going to go down to at least about $600, you know,
wow,
for over the year. And then probably for my electric, you know, the same type of thing, maybe, you know, 10 or 20%. So I'd say my savings is probably going to be at least $1,000 just in heating and cooling my house just for this year alone. So,
Chuck, that is huge. $1,000. And I think you have now brought us up to, in this, you know, silly total that we're going here, where I was hoping for $1,500 a year. We're now, if you add everybody's savings up, we're now at nearly $5,000. So thank you so much for your contribution. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
It is 46 minutes past the hour. How are you saving money? What is your favorite way to save? 404-872-0750. Maybe we can find $10,000 of savings. Shall we try? Sue joins us on the line from Mansfield. So, Sue, you save money on phone calls, cell phones?
Yes. What we actually did was my husband and I both had a cell phone through one of the national companies that was costing us about $105 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And we found out that my husband's work-provided cell phone was unlimited, so we canceled his personal cell phone altogether. And then I went to Walmart and got one of those straight talk deals, which is unlimited, for $45 a month.
Right.
So that saved $55 a month, and now we both have dependable cell phones, so we canceled our home phone service, which saved us about another $30.
Wow. That is amazing. So you're saving almost $90 a month, which is about $1,100 a year.
Yeah, just on phones.
Just on phones. Awesome. You have pushed us well over $5,000 in savings, Sue. Thank you so much. 47 minutes past the hour, 404-872-0750. What's your favorite way to save? How are you saving money? We are well on our way to getting to $10,000 in savings. Vanita joins us on the line. Hey, Vanita, welcome to the Elise Glink Show. What's your favorite way to save?
Well, I recently got laid off, so I've been looking all kinds of ways. And what I ended up doing, instead of looking at different cable plans, as I got rid of my cable altogether, I purchased a digital antenna, had it installed, and I basically got free TV.
Awesome. How much was the antenna?
The antenna plus the installation, and I do recommend, especially in the metro Atlanta area, having a professional installer do it.
What, you didn't want to climb up on your roof and do it yourself? Really? Really?
No, it was a little bit more, and it was a little bit more complicated than what,
yes,
I thought it might be, but it was $330, so, you know, I was paying just under $100 a month, and that was just, that wasn't, you know, I don't have all the premium channels and that kind of thing, so for me, it saved about $100 a month. It'll pay off in 3 months easily.
Right, and then, so for the first year, you'll save about $900.
Exactly.
And then $1,200 going forward, and you've made the trade-off because you're not getting all the premium channels,
exactly,
you were getting, but you're happy with that, and that's fine.
I am. In Metro Atlanta, you can get the network channels, Fox, several PBS channels. I mean, it is a trade-off, but, you know, I'm also learning now to read more and that kind of thing.
You know, it's,
I'm sorry. I have dogs in the car.
Maybe they have ways to save, too. Have you asked them? Maybe they're willing to trade down on their puppy chow. I don't know.
Well, I probably spend more on groceries for them than I do on myself. But anyway.
Well, if you're not going to, like, petsaver.com or something, I think that's probably a big mistake. Vanita, thank you so much for your call. It's great to find out that there are people who are still willing to trade down. down, get rid of cable, make those changes altogether. It's a finite amount of money we have, folks. You've got to make it go as far as you can. So we're on a mission today. We're on a mission to save you money on the everyday expenses. Every single day that you spend money, I want to figure out a way to save some. So 404-872-0750. You can tweet it at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. You can send me an email at thebrandnewthinklink.com. And we're going to have more of these coming up in a couple of minutes. In the meantime, we have news, weather, and traffic, and in today's Atlanta Journal-Constitution, there's an investigative report that exposes former university leaders who still collect state paychecks. Really, guys? 10 before the hour on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live and new to guide you through your money and real estate questions only on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB.
This Sunday morning. I'm Elise Glink. Thanks for listening to the show. 404-872-0750. How can you save $1,500 to $5,000? We are talking about that today and taking your suggestions. 404-872-0750. Jeffrey called, he tweeted me and said he canceled cable completely. Yes, it can be done. He switched to an HSA and is saving $1,200 a year just from these two. What are you doing to save money? Let's go back to the phones. Dan joins us on the line from Atlanta. Dan, what's your favorite way to save?
Yeah, this is Dan. One of my favorite ways to save is right now I'm up in around Lake Hartwell, and I started camping out like it was a Boy Scout a long time ago. So for $16, I go to this great little place. I'm not going to tell where it's at, a little hideaway, and I use their swimming pool, and I got an RV. I paid cash for it, but it broke down, so I'm getting it towed. It's under warranty, and I can plug it in for $25 a day, and I can watch their TV. And then I joined the gym in Atlanta, one of them, and I watched, so I canceled all my cable and TV, and I used their internet, and I used their TV to watch my basic ABC, CBS, or to get the news. And then I learned something that was kind of a new idea. It was called reading, and I started picking up used books and tapes. And my mom passed away like 3 years ago, and she used to love to read, and so I'm learning how to read again.
You're the second person today who said that. I think that's great. So tell me, what do you estimate you're saving with all of these different tricks of the trade?
I don't know, because what's even more scary is I used to fly for a living, and so I learned to use the Marriott points, and anytime I'd be on business, they're the best, and any of the hotel points, stay three, get one night free,
uh-huh.
And then a lot of the hotels you can eat for free there at the lobby.
Yeah.
Or just go in and tell them what you're doing. You're just watching the TV for a few minutes, and can I read the newspaper? And that's one way to save. Or if you're on business, you know, eat the free breakfast when you're paying for the hotel, then grab an apple and orange for lunch, and then they have the snacks at dinner, and get your make sure you get your AARP discount. I have friends that just don't want to do that, but for $16 a year,
you get all kinds of stuff. You sound like you've got a book in you, Dan, or at least a website.
I'm getting ready to start Burford Enterprise. I'm getting ready to help people get out of these real estate foreclosures, because I'm getting ready to go into foreclosure, and I've got a $324,000 condo that's worth $210,000. The best friends, I let people run over me. I did. That owe me now $16,000 on it.
It
is. I'm on the other side of the park renting a $16,000 apartment, and I said, what am I doing?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of places that you can find in your budget, and I hope that your foreclosure goes well. That's disturbing, but I'm glad you're finding ways to get on top of it. 404-872-0750 or tweet me. What's your favorite way to save? I'm Elise Glink. We'll be right back with more News Talk WSB.
It's live, expert money and real estate advice every Sunday. Elise Glink is on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM, News Talk WSB. Brought to you by Mark Tytel with Realty First.
Everybody to the Elise Glink Show live on Sundays 11 to 1 here on News Talk WSB. So glad you could join us here this Memorial Day weekend. We're delighted to have you on board. As always, the website, think Glink.com, THINKGLINK.com. Don't forget to sign up for my free weekly newsletter and check out that killer new search engine in ThinkLink.com. We have reorganized the site. I think it's a whole lot easier to find what you need on ThinkLink.com. We'll have show notes up a little bit after the show today, so you'll be able to check those out as well. And then don't forget to go to MoneyWatch.com. I don't know if you know this, but Maria Shriver and Arnold Schwarzenegger's former home is for sale. I'm just waiting for the announcement that their current home is for sale. I'm sure you are as well. And then over at the Equifax Personal Finance blog, we have all kinds of great information on the five pillars of personal finance. We've got real estate, tax, investments, insurance, and of course credit from Equifax's own credit experts. You can ask them questions and find out information at equifax.com/blog, B-L-O-G. With us this hour is an old friend of mine. I met him years and years ago. I don't even want to tell you how many years ago. We're almost at a decades old friendship here. My friend Steve Cook, he's the former Vice President of Public Affairs for the National Association of Realtors, which means he just knows about everything there is to do with realtors. Today he does a bunch of other things. He does guest blog for the Equifax Personal Finance blog. Excuse me. He also runs a website called Real Estate Economy Watch, which offers tremendous insights and intelligence on residential real estate. Very, very well-reported stuff. And then he also edits the real estate section for UPI. And Steve joins me today. There's a whole bunch of things I want to ask you about. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, it's nice to have you. So, you know, all things housing, I was on the phone this week with one of my good friends from the OCC, and we were talking about everything from loan modifications to how home buyers may actually, or I should say, former homeowners who were foreclosed on may be able to file for some financial remuneration. But then we got into a really interesting conversation about how the housing market has slowed almost to a point I don't think I've ever, for sure I haven't seen it, but I think we're looking at even slower than back in the 70s when we had stagflation. And really, I mean, the new home number is just astonishingly low, worst ever since they've been keeping records in 1963. And so my contact at the OCC and I were talking about how the number of sales for existing homes seems to not be as bad as the new home sales number. And I know you watch all this stuff, and I know that new home sales are down like 80% from the high. That is a depression by any definition. But existing home sales don't seem to be down quite as much. What do you think?
I agree with you, but you know, there was a little blip this week when the latest new home sales came out. They were up like 7%, I think, but compared to where they were, that's still pretty sad.
But they were down 23% from the year before.
Right, on a year-to-year basis. That's
crazy.
True. You know, I was reading something today in just kind of comments from realtors around the country, and this one guy wrote it, and he said, you know, the only people selling are people who are really in trouble financially, and the only people buying are the really wealthy people who don't have to go out and get financing for it. There's so many things going on that are making the market slow down. The difficulties people are having getting financing, just the economy as a whole. Of course, we continue to have the problems with distressed sales. And you know, it's kind of like Charles Dickens. It's kind of the best of times and the worst of times. It's the best of times for some people in the real estate market, and it's the worst of times for others.
Yeah, for a whole lot of other people. One number that's caught my mind, and I'd love to get your take on this, is the idea that distressed home sales, whether it's short sales or foreclosures, are now accounting for, is this right, 60% of all home sales?
Yeah, that could be. You know, it's a hard figure to nail down, but it's certainly over 50, and it's a record. That's not going to continue.
Yeah.
I think that we see the signs that delinquencies now for about a year have been slowly declining. But what's driving the market right now is that the banks suddenly got busy again and processed a whole bunch of foreclosures that were in the pipeline. So you see, I don't know, something like 2 million, over 2.2 million foreclosures that are coming on market. So it's, you know, there is, you can look in your local real estate listing. There's as many distressed sales as ever.
And then on the other side, investors are now at a record level. You know, people who are not buying homes to live in but are buying homes to as investments. I think that number has shot up to something like over 20%. Is that right?
Yeah, and I've just been involved in a new study that's actually coming out tomorrow on investors. And one of the things that I mentioned a moment ago, this is kind of the best of times for some people. It's the best of times right now for investors for a couple of reasons. One is that, as we were saying, you can get property today at bargain basement levels in just about every market of the country. Prices you're just not going to see again. I mean, at some point, you know, we are going to reach, I guess the term now is an organic bottom.
Come up with a new name for it, huh?
Yeah, well, you know, we no longer have the impact of the tax credit from last year. That's all now washed through the system, and the decline that happened in the marketplace in terms of prices after that now has gone down. It may, you know, some people are saying it's going to go down a bit further, but, you know, not a lot further. So, you know, for the investor, this is the time to move. But you have to remember, the investor has two issues. He has to not only buy, when the market's down, he's got to be able to sell when the market's up. So a lot of investors have been sitting back and waiting until they can also see that turn in the market coming.
Right.
They may not want to hold that property for 5 or 7 years to see prices appreciate. They may want to be able to turn it over in a couple of years. So that's why I say right now at this time, when we're on the cusp of maybe the lowest trough in prices, we can then look ahead to, you know, maybe it's not going to be quick. I mean, that's one thing everybody agrees with. The increase in prices is going to be one step at a time over the next couple, 2-3 years. And another issue that's come up that people ask is, you know, will it return to where it was? And we really don't know if prices ever will get back to the
level. Hey, NASDAQ. NASDAQ is still nowhere near 5,000, right?
Right. Right, exactly. And, that question sort of is asking the question, what will the housing market look like in 2 or 3 years in terms of home ownership? You know, the percentage of people who want to own homes. The fact is home ownership is down 4 percentage points from where it was in 2006, and that's really dramatic. Those are the kinds of longer-term trends that are going to shape the housing demand in the years to come. But the other reason that housing prices are not going to appreciate quickly is that there are literally millions of homeowners out there who have been waiting to sell, and they've been trapped by either the market or the market in the combination with the fact that they're underwater on their mortgages and they just can't afford to sell.
Mm-hmm.
But when the prices do start to appreciate in their marketplaces, maybe as little as 3-5%, you're going to see a lot of those people starting to sell because the same reasons people have always wanted to sell. Maybe they're retired people who want to get out of their empty nest, or maybe they're growing families that need more space and have had to delay those kinds of decisions. You know, the average American family moved every 7 years up until a couple of years ago, and now the average American family moves 8 years, and it's that's been extending the horizon outward solely because of the market.
It's fascinating. It's really amazing. And I know that this week on realestateeconomywatch.com, you were writing about how appraisals are still killing home sales. And it's sort of an interesting, I mean, the poor appraisers, you know, they were skewered for giving overblown appraisals, and now that they're giving, you know, what many consider to be, you know, more realistic appraisals, they're getting skewered on the other side because the deals don't close.
I know. Appraisals are definitely, they're like the umpire in the baseball game, you know.
Nobody likes them.
You know.
Kill the appraiser. No, I'm
right.
Just kidding.
If one side isn't happy, then the other side isn't happy.
Right.
And in fact, at least this idea from that story came from an incident with my son who just bought a short sale in Northern Virginia. And his appraisal came in low, and he was able to get the bank that owned the property that's doing the short sale to agree to lower the price, which I thought was pretty cool. A lot of people can't do that because not only are about 15% or so of property deals right now being renegotiated because of low appraisals. About 10% of them are just plain not going through. So, this has always been a problem in a way when the market changes dramatically. And it's, you know, I mentioned in the story the whole situation with this appraisal rule that's been a big issue for the last couple of years.
Let me just tell everybody, you're talking about the HVCC,
right,
which we've talked about, the Home Valuation Code of Conduct, which is crazy.
And that's finally resolved.
Update us. How did they resolve it?
Well, they basically, Congress last year in the financial reform legislation included a rider that just basically killed it. It's basically killed the whole HVCC regulation and said that you know, went back to square zero and said that appraisers are free to work on their own. They don't have to work through these management companies. That there has to be, you know, the realtor cannot order the appraiser as HVCC maintained. But it didn't, you know, what it didn't address, one of the issues that came up in the HVC was the HVCC required the appraiser to include foreclosed property sales as well as normal property sales when they came up with valuation. That language also was removed. But that issue is still out there. And so when you look at something, as you mentioned ago, where 60% of the sales are distressed properties, and those distressed properties may be going at maybe a 20 or 30% discount under the other properties, of course that has the impact of lowering the values for all properties, and of course it's going to have an impact when it comes to appraising a property. And that's one reason that valuations continue to be significantly low, you know, maybe 5% lower often in many cases than they would have been otherwise.
We are talking with Steve Cook, my good friend. He is the author, or I should say publisher, of realestateeconomywatch.com, which offers insights and intelligence on residential real estate. He's also a blogger for the Equifax Personal Finance blog, and he's the former vice president of public affairs for the National Association of Realtors. So he really knows real estate, and we're going to talk to him a little bit more. So stay tuned. You're listening to AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on.
Welcome back,
weekdays with Clark Howard and Dave Ramsey.
404-872-0750. This Memorial Day weekend, we're talking with my good friend Steve Cook. He knows so much about real estate. He spent years as the vice president of public affairs for the National Association of Realtors and now blogs about real estate at realestateeconomywatch.com and at the Equifax Personal Finance blog. So, Steve, you know, I know you own a timeshare, but what do you think about the general market for vacation property? I mean, with all the wacky weather we've had, everything from tornadoes and now we're getting into the hurricane season, is there a recovery in store for vacation property?
Well, there is, and it's a great time to talk about it since it's Memorial Day weekend. And traditionally in the real estate biz, this is the time that the whole second home market sort of kicks off, and families, you know, as they're out on vacation, start thinking about buying a place. And this year, the economics of it are really pretty good for the buyer. I had a chance to analyze some MLS data in a lot of real estate markets, resort markets around the country, and there are some markets where, like Myrtle Beach comes to mind, which I know is not far from folks in Atlanta, is a market where it really has not recovered. And, you know, there's a combination of issues there. One is the economy and the unemployment rate, which are also important factors. But there's some really great buys in vacation properties in places like that. So if you look around at traditional second home markets, even retirement community type markets, right now a lot of those places are areas where people have sold the property to, you know, for financial reasons. Many of them, there have been a lot of foreclosures in a lot of these markets, and the demand has not been great because of the economy over recent years. So the inventory is large. So you have a nice selection of properties to look at, and prices are very reasonable. And you know, in time they will pick up and improve. But right now seems to be a good time for that.
There's one other
factor going on.
Oh, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Yes. In some resort markets, and that is foreign investors. Foreign investment is really picking up in places like the west coast of Florida because they see a lot of foreign buyers are coming in because they see the value. Canadians, people from Central and South America are getting an advantage because of the devalued dollar. And they're able to come into some of these markets and really make a good, solid investment. So a significant number of sales now are going to support investors.
It's really, really interesting. And I know that it's happening not just in Florida, but, of course, California is seeing a lot of it. And even in New York, they're talking about sort of A-list cities, New York, Paris, London, Hong Kong, places that Russian oligarchs, I suppose, have a few extra billion dollars to throw around or tuning in and buying up. We're talking with Steve Cook of Real Estate Economy Watch and the Equifax Personal Finance blog. All things real estate, I want to talk a little bit about first-time buyers when we come back. So stay tuned to AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB. Welcome back, everybody.
Anytime.
So glad you could join us this Memorial Day weekend. Don't forget to go online, check out Think thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. Sign up for the free weekly newsletter. It is your passport to all things Glink. Facebook, Twitter, the fan page, all kinds of fun stuff. Thinkglink.com. And while you're at it, don't forget to check out the Equifax Personal Finance blog and my home equity blog at MoneyWatch.com. We're talking with Steve Cook. He's an old friend of mine, the former Vice President of Public Affairs for the National Association of Realtors. But he's now writing and blogging about real estate. He's blogging at the Equifax Personal Finance blog and, of course, at Real Estate Economy Watch, which offers insight and intelligence on residential real estate. So, Steve, one of the things you wrote last week is about how you see first-time home buyers kind of evaporating. And I told you during the break that I actually know this to be true because my own book sales are completely dismal at the moment. But why? What is this that you're seeing, and why do you think first-time buyers are disappearing?
I don't think it's really a complicated reason. First of all, you know, we had a buildup of demand among first-time buyers beginning in the, say, 2004, 2005 era when they couldn't afford to get into a lot of the housing because of the prices at that time. And even when prices came down, many first-time buyers still couldn't get into the market. But with the more affordable prices last year, and then, of course, the first-time homebuyer tax credit, which really lasted for about a total of 18 months, that was enough to get a lot of buyers into. And you saw a real big increase in first-time buyer sales a year ago,
sure.
12 months ago, because that credit actually ended for all practical purposes on April 30, 2010. With that also came, a lot of those first-time buyers bought up a lot of the available entry-level type housing in many markets of the country. So not only do you have a dearth now of first-time buyers, they don't have the selection of property that was out there, say, a year ago. So those two things put together, but I think the real problem right now that someone who wants to get into the market is going to be one of finding the right financing, and it's just simply the difficulty that a lot of lenders are having complying with changing regulations is still making it hard for a lot of first-time buyers who may not have enough money for the down payment or who may not have a history of credit adequate in order to get the loan that they need. Life is harder now to be a first-time buyer, but it's not impossible. In many of these markets, you're seeing first-time home buyers compete with investors for foreclosure properties or distressed sale properties. But if you hang in with it, you can get those kind of properties. Again, if you have your financing lined up, and that's the key.
Well, financing is sort of interesting because this week we watched 30-year fixed-rate loans sink to about under 4.5%. 15-year loans are about 3.65%. They've sunk as well. And a 5-1 adjustable rate mortgage, if you only need a loan for 5 years, 2.86%. I mean, we're talking about levels that I don't think have ever been seen. They're lower, almost as low as they were, I don't know when it was, back in November, when I think the 30-year fixed rate loan touched about 4.3% very briefly. Like, if you held your breath, it was about as long as it was there.
Rates and the lower prices are really creating like a once in a generation opportunity to become a homeowner, for a first time buyer. The big hurdle for so many first time buyers, though, is the down payment. But that doesn't have to be such a problem. There's some answers to that problem. Number one, the first answer that everybody ought to look at is FHA financing, which today is still something like 35% of the market.
But expensive.
Yeah, but it's a 3.5% down payment instead of a 10% or even more than that. Secondly, there are, this is something I learned recently, by the way, actually from a realtor there in Atlanta who has put together an amazing database of down payment assistance programs around the country. There are several thousand down payment assistance programs, usually funded by local governments, local housing authorities, state housing authorities, to help first-time buyers, to help public workers, public employees, affordable housing, that sort of thing, get into the marketplace. And they'll couple those with an FHA loan to provide you with either a loan or a grant to cover your down payment so you can get into the home virtually without putting any money down at all. And it has, it has to be like, middle class or lower middle class. It's not something to buy an expensive home with. But for someone who qualifies, it's a great deal. So you should really check out programs that exist with your local housing authority.
Yeah, that's true. In my book, Buy Close, Move In, which is the one I wrote last year, the one that's really not selling, in that book I talk about how to find these programs, because while they are funded mostly by community development block grants, which it could be used, who knows, to pay for Medicare one of these days, but at the moment they're being used to sort of push out the first-time buyer stuff. The housing authorities are really the places that are distributing this kind of thing. So in Atlanta, there's the Atlanta Authority, but they're all, as you point out, they're all over the country, and they are great to work with. When you're looking as a first-time home buyer, it's kind of interesting because I think that many first-time home buyers are unaware of, they don't just need down payment cash, they need closing cost cash, they need reserves. There's all kinds of cash you need, even with an FHA loan. Do you think that there's just a lack of understanding with new buyers who are out there today of the reality of the market?
You know, yes, I do, but I don't think that's anything new. I think that you know, many people, you know, getting into the whole process of buying a home is a lot more complicated than many people realize when they first get into it. But what is different today is that there's tools out there, there's information out there that you can access that can empower you to really take charge of the transaction. For example, most people don't understand that the mortgage rate that they hear about or that they see in the ad put out by the lender is not the mortgage rate that they're personally going to end up with. Their personal mortgage rate is going to reflect their own credit history. It's going to affect the amount of money they're putting down. It's going to affect their loan-to-income ratio. It's going to affect. It's going to reflect about 12 different factors that go into the underwriting of their loan, and out the other end comes a mortgage, which is usually higher than the number they see, because the number they see reflects what the very, very best level of credit type borrow is going to be able to get. Well, that mortgage rate's important because it's going to affect your, you know, it's what you use to help calculate what your monthly costs will be, what the overall cost of the loan will be. It helps when you make decisions about what kind of a loan you want to take out. These are the kinds of things that just a couple of years ago, you know, you kind of had to do on the back of an envelope. Today, you can go on the internet, you can find websites that actually calculate this information for you. There's ways to actually even get automated underwriting done in advance of even getting, you know, making your first call to look at a house. So you can look at where you stand financially, you know, to the dollar, and understand what your obligation will be as you look at properties. And that's the key. If you know where you stand financially before you start the house hunt, you're in much better shape than if you go out and fall in love with a home and then you sit there and try to find ways to stretch your finances to pay for a home that, you know, that may not end up being the best deal for you.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think first-time buyers have a lot to learn about this market. And I think really the onus is on the realtors and on the lenders to try and get them there. I just think that there's so much going on that changes day to day. We are talking with Steve Cook. Steve is a longtime friend of mine. I won't even talk about years, but he is the blogger behind Real Estate Economy Watch, which offers insight and intelligence on residential real estate. He also blogs for the Equifax Personal Finance blog. And in just the minute or two we have left, Steve, just a word or two on luxury homes. I know that luxury homes have really actually been spending very little time, relatively speaking, on the market. And even though inventories are rising, you know, are rich people buying homes?
They are, and they're probably buying homes at a higher pace right now than the average person. And the reason is, number one, rich people, believe it or not, you know, even though they've got a lot of money, they're very careful about their money, and they're very aware of a good deal when they see one. I'm making a lot of generalizations now, but the fact is that there are a whole lot of good deals out there in luxury homes, just like every other form of housing. Again, you're seeing prices on some properties that you'll never see again. So It's a time to pick up properties, more or less for a song, you know, and these folks know that it's an investment that will appreciate over time.
You know, it's kind of interesting. Last week I reported on my Money Watch blog that realtor data had undergone a reporting change, and it's sort of interesting. I just wonder if it all just seems so depressing now to have homes that have been on the market for 700 days. So, for example, in Savannah, Georgia, Realtor.com's real estate data report for March showed that the median age of housing inventory was 701 days. And then the April report showed that now it's only 198 days on the market. And we asked the realtors what they were doing, and we said, are you playing funny with the listing data? And they're like, no, we're just adjusting the methodology. But You know, I was thinking about that when I looked at your luxury home story on Real Estate Economy Watch and how luxury homes over $1 million are spending just 118 days on the market. It's far less than the average or the median listing number of days.
Yeah, you know, you would be absolutely shocked to know what the average, it's well over a year. And, it's very long, let me put it that way. And wealthy, the luxury homes have, in the last year or so, had extraordinary long, the term is days on market. They've had extraordinary long periods in the marketplace before they're sold. One of the things that happens when a property is on the market that long is it puts pressure on the seller to lower the price.
Sure.
So that's one reason you'll see, you know, most people don't plan to have it in limbo that long, and so they want to move it, and so they'll lower the price in order to move it.
Right. Well, I know there are a lot of sellers who want to get rid of their property. That's
when
for sure.
When you see the days on market start to decline, like you see, really since about the 1st of March with luxury homes. By luxury homes, we're talking about homes over $1 million in price. When you start to see that days on market period shorten, that means there's less pressure to lower the price for one thing, and that means that on the other side that demand is picking up. But I believe that it's largely a result of the people who can't afford to buy these properties are buying them because they see the value right now in doing it.
We've had Steve Cook with us this hour. Steve is with realestateeconomywatch.com. This is a great website full of really terrific information about housing markets, housing forecasts, crisis, investment watch, housing data, and providing market commentary. He also blogs on the Equifax personal finance blog, equifax.com/blog, where I think he recently wrote about housing trends. Steve, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Elise.
We'll have to have
a great Memorial Day weekend.
Thank you. You too. We'll have to have you back again. Stay tuned. Mark Tytel is in the studio talking about short sales and foreclosures and how some changes that he is seeing come across his desk are going to make change for you as well. You're listening to AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live and new to guide you through your money and real estate questions only on AM 750 and now 95.5 FM News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. We're here this Memorial Day weekend. We hope you're going to have a great time the rest of the weekend. Enjoy the weather, your family, maybe some good barbecue. I don't know. We got big plans ourselves, and I know you do as well. With me in the studio, we have Mark Tytel of GetOutStartOver.com. He is our eyes and ears on the ground with regard to short sales and foreclosures. Mark, happy to have you back on the show.
Great to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the new statistics that you're seeing this week. What crossed your desk?
Well, what we saw this week is that CoreLogic Company is the only one in the country right now that is tracking down short sales after the closing to see whether there are possible fraud in the transactions going on across the country.
Yeah, fraud is an increasing problem, and it has been for the last couple of years with regard to there's mortgage fraud, but there's also been foreclosure fraud. And now, of course, you're talking about short sale fraud. So how much is short sale fraud estimated to cost banks?
Well, right now we have it. 2011 will probably cost banks about $375 million in losses.
Wow. That is a huge amount. And I don't know, where is the fraud occurring? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the biggest problem is with the investors, you know, and the way banks are tracking all of this based on the numbers. Because, you know, all banks are about numbers. So they're looking at the numbers and they're looking what happened to the short sale after the closing, after the bank sold it. What happened after the 30 days, 60 days, 90 days? And if they sold for more than 10% of what the bank sold, that is a suspicious transaction. So if 30 days, 10%, and then if it is less than 3 months and for 20% profit, it is a suspicious transaction. And, you know, after the 6 months, if it's more than 40% resale value, then there may be a suspicion and fraud.
Now, that's interesting. So one of the things you've talked to with me about is that the transactions that were flipped within 24 hours CoreLogic is finding that they showed a 34% profit.
That's correct.
In 24 hours, I want that deal. Can you get that deal for me, Mark?
That's exactly right. On average, any and all of the transactions that were flipped within 24 hours showed 34% of profit. Now, not all of them are fraudulent, but most of it probably will, because what can you do as an investor in terms of repairing the property and increasing the value within 24 hours? You cannot, you know, repaint, rebuild, and all that in 24 hours and actually enter into binding contract and sell and close and make that profit. That's why it's very suspicious.
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, it only happens in 24 hours on HGTV television programs. For the rest of the world, just getting the contractor to show up to do a bid, that in itself is a long thing. In my office, we've been trying to replace an air conditioner. Guy, like, got three-quarters of the way there. It's been 3 days since he's been back, so
absolutely.
I don't know.
Absolutely. And especially in the hot season, you know, when everybody is lined up waiting for their turn. So likelihood of the investor really improving the profit property for that much money is very little.
So, you know, in terms of a seller or a buyer, how do you know if a short sale is fraudulent? And are lenders going back and then turning over these deals?
Well, this is the key. This is the reason why we're having this conversation, is to protect our sellers, to make sure they're not ending up in the fraudulent short sale transaction. Because what the sellers really want is to get the deficiency balance forgiven. And usually when you get the short sale approval, lately all the banks are giving waivers on the deficiency balance. But if the fraud is involved, guess what? This waiver may not be valid anymore, and they can come back and sue and seek for the deficiency balance, even though they released that at the time of closing.
So let me just ask you one last quick question. I mean, the banks have to approve the short sale price. You told us last week, I think, or maybe it was the week before, that they're basically approving about 88-89% of the listing price, or the appraised price. Don't the banks have the final say? Aren't they doing any due diligence here?
Absolutely. And that is why CoreLogic Corporation came up with all those numbers, so they can help and lend a hand to the banks to really seek out and look what's happening, so they will not end up losing so much money as they are predicted to lose this year.
Amazing. Mark Tytel with GetOutStartOver.com, our eyes and ears on the ground for short sales and foreclosures. Thanks for coming on the show. Happy Memorial Day.
Thank you.
Been nice to have you. All right, folks, it looks like our time is up. Time for me to go out and enjoy this Memorial Day weekend, and I hope you do as well. Remember, drive safe and stay tuned to News Talk WSB so that you get all of the latest news, weather, and traffic right here. Don't forget to go to thinklink.com, where we're going to have the blog available for today's show notes and updates. Thanks again for listening, everybody. Have a great week.